We're going to welcome our next guest, Bob Chamberlain. He's the president of MTI, Monterey Technologies Incorporated, which is based here in Park City. Now, they've developed a product called VIPER, Visual Planning, Execution, and Review. The software lets military and commercial planners execute complex missions on the fly. Monterey Technologies has just been named a small business innovation research success story for this VIPER mission planning application. Bob Chamberlain, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
So there are so many places that we could start talking about your business, but why don't you just give us the background of how long you've been going, and then why are you based here in Park City?
Okay. So Monterey Technologies was started in 1984 by three PhD experimental psychologists. And the focus is on what's called human factors engineering. So we have been a federal government contractor since 1984. You know, our client base is, you know, DOD, Army, Navy, Air Force, NASA, FAA, Department of Transportation, a handful of others, the Australian government. My last partner retired. I joined the company in 1997, merged my small business into Monterey Technologies. So over the years, the other three partners either left or retired. And in 2012, my last partner retired, and I acquired his stock and became the sole owner of the company. All three of those guys were California boys. So they picked Monterey, California as the place they wanted to headquarter. I found over the years that the regulatory environment in California was pretty tough for small business. And I happen to like to ski, so I have a good friend who's a Delta captain here in Park City, and he said, well, why don't you move here? So in 2012, we bought a house, and we started the process of transitioning. It took about a year and a half, but, you know, we got our Monterey office closed down and established headquarters here in Park City. So that's sort of how we got here.
Well, that seems like an easy story. So I'm picturing this, Bob. I'm at a, you know, cocktail party with you, and I start talking to you about what you do. And the way I see you explaining it to me is sort of twofold. One is I'm sitting in front of my computer and I'm thinking, wow, they make every approach to this so complex. It's not intuitive. You know, I'm so turned off by technology. I wish there was a business out there that made things simple. That's one thing. And then the other thing is this whole military application that, wow, it's just crazy.
Yes. You know, we have focused on this issue of usability, I'll call it. When system and product designers put together a team to design a product, they'll generate something called a functional specification, and it's this big laundry list of everything that the system or product needs to do. And they'll get a set of constraints. It can only weigh this much, it can only use this much electrical power, it can only be this big. And the engineering team goes about designing a product that provides all the functionality and meets all the constraints. And the user is the last thing on their mind. They have no idea what the users need to do with this thing. So you end up with these products that frustrate people because they're hard to use. So, you know, the science of experimental psychology is specifically directed at looking at these issues. What does the user need to do? How do they perceive data and information? And can you build functionality and a user interface that absolutely makes sense to the users and still does all this stuff that the product needs to do and meets the constraints? So, I mean, there are any number of examples of how we've applied human engineering to the design process. You know, we happen to gravitate into military systems because you have such incredibly complex systems that do so much. And when the system designers make a product very complex, it doubles or triples the training time, and that gets really expensive. So, you know, that's sort of our focus, is how do we work with both the engineering team and the end users to make sure that the product does what it needs to do, but it's intuitive and easy to use.
Bob, when we were on the golf course, we talked together about a hypothetical situation, and I just want to set it up, set up the hypothetical and let you take it from there.
Sure.
There's an attack submarine that leaves Virginia. It's heading towards Scotland for a series of military operations that it has been planning for weeks to put together. It's a 3,500-mile trip. About a day outside of Virginia, it gets an emergency call saying all hell's broken loose in the Arabian Sea. You need to steam to the Arabian Sea immediately, which is 9,000 miles away. You got to go through the Suez Canal. You need to figure out the route you're going to take. You need to figure out who the bad guys are, all the contingency plans, something that could take weeks to plan. What happens next with your product?
Well, you know, let me preface that, you know, my personal background is naval aviation, and you're talking about a submarine application. And our mission planning tool is integrated into the combat system on all U.S. Navy, British Navy, and Australian Navy submarines. The specific planning issue, the navigator on a submarine, when he gets that tasking you just described, must plot an underwater route. You know, it's like taking out an old, you know, AAA, you know, map of the United States that shows all the roads. You know, he's got to plot this underwater route from where they are to where they need to go. And he can put in such things as, what time do we need to be there? How many days do I have to do this? One of the requirements that the navigator must accomplish and provide to the captain of the submarine, he must identify the shallowest point in that overall route. Not being a submariner, I imagine it would ruin everybody's day if you happen to run into something underwater. Now, to identify the shallowest point in the route that he's plotting, traditionally, he would have to sift through 6 or 7 or 8 different sorts of charts. And it was an incredibly labor-intensive, time-consuming operation to do this. So a part of what our Viper mission planning tool does is we take inputs from all of those charts. And, you know, we've created a function within our planning tool that will identify the shallowest point. And so all the navigator has to do then is put in the route, push the button that says identify, you know, the shallowest point. And, you know, the computer chugs away for a couple of minutes and identifies it and puts a symbol on the route that he can then show to the captain of the submarine. So our tool has just saved that guy probably 8 or 9 hours of planning time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's the focus of the tool.
And your product is strategically important to U.S. security. How do you ensure that the product does not get in the hands of the bad guys?
Well, in and of itself, you know, the tool, you know, isn't classified or anything. It's just the data that you put into it. So, you know, if it's embedded in the combat system of a Navy submarine, obviously it's not going to get into anybody else's hands. We have an air version that does complex multi-aircraft strike planning, so that's resident on all U.S. aircraft carriers. So, you know, there's really no chance that it's going to get into the wrong hands. With commercial sorts of applications, things like, you know, international disaster response relief. You know, you could provide the software tool and there's nothing, you know, classified about it. It's just the way that people use it. So, you know, we really don't see this as an issue.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Bob Chamberlain. He's the president of Monterey Technologies Incorporated, based here in Park City. Bob, how many do you employ here in Park City, or do you have people sort of scattered all over the country?
Yeah, the company has about 40 employees overall. Our technical people are scattered all over the place. We have a bunch in Seattle, in San Diego, Virginia, Florida, Colorado. We have a small headquarters staff here over on Sun Peak Drive. So, you know, we do the company administration and HR and accounting and, you know, all the back office stuff here. So we've got 7 people total here.
Do you still hire experimental psychologists?
Yes, indeed.
I think this is so great. Yeah, talk about that. Talk about the kind of people that you're using still and, you know, in what capacity and what are you asking them to do that might be a divergent path from the traditional sense of the psychology field?
Yeah, you know, the field of experimental psychology is somewhat different than the I'll call it the clinical side. You know, my wife is on the clinical side. It's a licensed clinical social worker. So you can get a master's degree in experimental psychology or a PhD. The University of Utah actually now has, I believe, a certificate program at the undergraduate level in human factors. So experimental psychologists are very good at quantitative data collection and analysis. You know, some of our standard products, we do task analysis where you're looking in a very detailed minute-to-minute, second-by-second view of how a user interacts with the technology they're given. We do workloads and workflows analysis that shows all of the interdependencies. Now, I'll just give you one simple example that people can typically relate to. So, well, before COVID-19, you're on an airplane, commercial airliner, and the captain proudly announces that you have arrived at your destination 20 minutes early. They taxi in to the gate and sit there 20 feet short of the gate because there isn't a ground crew to park the airplane and there's not a gate agent to drive the jetway. This is what we call a just-in-time information issue that the airlines have. You know, that ground crew may be at another gate, either pushing back an aircraft or are parking another one. So they don't have the right information in the right time. So we look at, from a human factors standpoint, the workloads workflows analysis shows how the flow of work for all the critical people should go. The task analysis looks specifically at what is each person's job, how do they do it, and how should the information they need to better do their jobs or more efficiently do their jobs be presented to them. You know, what's the right form factor of technology? You know, is it some wearable device? Is it an iPad that they carry? Is it on their phone? You know, there's a variety of choices. And until you do the analysis, the task analysis and the workloads workflows, you don't really know. And a company that builds a product will be more than happy to go sell the airlines a product saying this is going to solve all your problems. But they haven't done the analysis, so they don't really know. So, you know, these are the sorts of things we do.
So, Bob, give us some examples, some additional examples of non-military applications. For an example, international relief efforts or wildfire response.
Well, you know, when you look at the situation in Southern California, when they have one of these big wildfires, you have a variety of different users, and this is where our Viper mission planning tool could probably be applied. So you've got to manage fixed-wing aircraft, helicopters, you know, both dropping water or fire retardant. You've got firefighters, trucks, first responders, ambulance, you know, police, you know, this whole host of people that you need to try and coordinate and figure out where they are and where they need to go. And you have to do this in the midst of some of the busiest commercial airspace in the world. Right now, there is no planning tool that allows, you know, this team, this large team of people, to look at it geographically on an electronic map, which is what our Viper system does, and be able to coordinate and task and plan and then go execute, see how things are going on the fly, and as actual events diverge from the plan, to be able to replan on the fly to take care of this sort of situation. So, I mean, this is essentially what our mission planning tool was designed to do. Right now, it's only military. You know, we're looking at a number of quasi-commercial applications like that.
I can imagine it would also come in pretty handy in an international relief problem, like in Haiti several years ago.
Yes. So, you know, having a military background, I was reasonably well aware of some of the challenges, you know, like putting Army helicopters on the deck of, you know, a big Navy helicopter carrier and having them fly on and off. This was new to them. You know, the challenge is, you know, we had a virtual armada of ships and supplies and you name it, descending on the harbor in the capital city of Haiti, which was in shambles. And, you know, the challenge is knowing what you have, where it is, who needs it, where they are, how you're going to get it from where it is to where it needs to be, and what the priority order of delivery is going to be. And this is, you know, a complex but reasonably straightforward planning issue. So our Viper mission planning tool provides a lot of clarity in that the, you know, the planners can plan right in this electronic map and, you know, make the determinations on how you're going to get stuff from where it is to where it needs to be, and, you know, what sorts of platforms are going to carry it, and, you know, where the people who really need the stuff are. You know, without a tool like ours, it just becomes almost insurmountable.
It's just fascinating, Bob, everything you do. And, you know, it kind of takes me back to, you know, as we know, Steve Jobs talked about how simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. And even though what you're talking about is very complex, it also is, I can picture you sitting around in some of your human systems integration analysis, just thinking about how do we get back to simple? How do we get back to simple? And then put layers of simple on top, you know, to kind of burp out this incredible product that, you know, makes us all say, gee, why didn't we think of that?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if I may, I'll describe another example of the human factors work that most people can relate to. So years ago, we had a project with a hotel chain. And they brought us in because they thought their maids were slacking off. You know, they weren't getting the rooms turned over. And if you're a customer and you walk up to the front desk of a hotel at 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon, and they tell you your room's not ready, you're an unhappy customer.
Right.
So we all know that the drill on hotels is, they want you to check out by 11 or noon, and they don't want you to check in before 4, and they use that time in between to get all the rooms clean. So this hotel was having a problem. They brought us in to look at the situation. Well, you know, your first challenge as a human factors company is sitting down and talking with the maid staff and say, look, we're not here to try and take your jobs away from you. We are here to look at the technology that you have been given with which to do your jobs and see if we can make any improvements that will help make you guys more efficient. So we started following the maids around and videotaping and audio taping and, you know, deconstructing that in our lab and, you know, documenting the task analysis and all this stuff. Well, what we found, you know, everybody has seen the big carts the maids have. Well, in this case, their cart, the center of the cart was the trash receptacle. So the maid would go into room one, pull out all the waste baskets, dump them in the middle of their big cart, put them back, clean the room, go to the next room, do the same thing. They were only getting through 3 to 4 rooms before the center of the cart was full. Well, what did they have to do then? They had to wheel that cart to the service elevator, take it to the ground floor, wheel it out into the back where the dumpster was, empty the trash into the dumpster, take that big cart back up and resume. And they were having to empty their carts 3 and 4 times a shift. And that was what was cutting down on their efficiency. So we provided their management with a modification to the cart design. Said, look, your problem is not with your maids, it's with your cart design. And if you redesign it to look like this, you'll triple the trash capacity on the cart, and they won't have to make but one trip instead of 3 to 4. It solved the problem. So this is how we look at applying human factors to everyday problems.
Oh, I love that. So I have a friend who works remotely here in Park City, but he works for a company called Dialogue that does essentially kind of leadership retreats. And it's funny because over the last couple months, he's been talking to me about how they're trying to build some software into their systems that would take all of the information of someone coming to their retreat, you know, whether they're, you know, if their plane's going to be, you know, 10 minutes late, what the trickle down is, and they can just plug everything in and have all of this trickle down all taken care of, and, you know, transportation from the airport, hotel check-in, all of that. It's kind of exactly what you're talking about with the cleaning cart at the hotel. But it makes me wonder, you know, he sort of had to hire a software developer on a private, just find someone who could do that for them and build in the software. But your clients, for example, you know, is that sort of thing something that you would do for a smaller client? Or, you know, how do you assess your workload and who you're going to take on and for which projects?
Well, here's one of the challenges. We pay our experimental psychologists with, you know, 10 to 20 years of experience, a pretty decent salary. They're doing high quality work. When you have these big military products or projects, you can sustain that. If you have a small client, they typically really don't have the budget. They'll come to us and say, you know, can you help us do this? What would it cost? And we say, well, somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000. And, you know, you get, you know, white faces going, oh my goodness, really? But we sort of look at this issue as, well, what are you going to spend on the software development to end up with a product that's so complex that your users can't use it?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, one of my retired partners loved to say selling human factors engineering is like pushing a rope. It's hard to get people to commit to spending that. But when they see the quality of product that comes out the end when you do human engineering, it really does make a difference.
Absolutely. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, Bob. It's really interesting what you do, and we have so many interesting people who live here and are based, have based their companies here in Park City. So, Bob Chamberlain, Monterey Technologies Incorporated, thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
All right. Loved it, Bob. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right.